Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastick. And first, a correction. This week, it's not Smarty Pants, actually. It's CSI Roman Empire. And with the help of a historian, we are going to figure out what killed our sprawling behemoth of a historical victim. And it might not be what you think. The Roman Empire's reputation precedes it. A wingspan that stretched from Syria to Spain and from the Nile to Scotland's doorstep, centuries of unbroken rule, nearly a quarter of the world's population at one point, and of course, museums and libraries worth of artistic artifacts and writings. And then it all came tumbling down. Why and how Rome fell has been a favored subject of armchair theorizing pretty much since it started teetering all those centuries ago. Somewhere on the order of 200-odd hypotheses have been proposed, according to one German historian. But we're not done yet. Into the fray comes historian Kyle Harper, the author of The Fate of Rome, Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire. He's joining us from his post at the University of Oklahoma to advance a new theory about why and how the Roman Empire fell. Thanks for being on the show, Kyle.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
So what's different about the argument that you're making about the fall of Rome?
Well, you're exactly right. There's no shortage of hypotheses. In fact, there's probably more hypotheses than there is problem to explain. But what's really exciting is that over the last few years, we have new information. And we don't always get that in ancient history, although given the fact that there's great archaeology and there's always new texts being discovered and new interpretations, even ancient history is always changing. But the last few years have been really stunning. The new information that we have, thanks largely to natural scientific disciplines like paleoclimatology and like genomics, for historians has been really an unexpected bonanza of new insights. And so we can now understand things about the world that the Romans lived in that we just simply didn't know 5 or 10 years ago. And that includes new information about the history of the climate and the ways that it has varied and changed over the last few millennia. And it includes, in particular, new insights into biological change, the evolution of pathogens, new germs that have evolved and arrived on the scene and had an enormous impact on life and death in the Roman Empire, and really added entirely new dimensions to the way we can understand the ancient past.
So what is your big argument about Rome? How have you managed to incorporate this new information into a new hypothesis about Rome's fall?
The big argument is that the environment is one of the major factors in the process that we call the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And the environment is not stable, and it's a major agent. It's a major player in history. It's not this unchanging backdrop against which humans play out their own history. The environment is part of the story itself, and environmental change has profound ramifications for the Roman Empire. That includes both changes in the climate. The Romans built their empire at a period of climate history when conditions were very favorable. If you're trying to build a civilization whose economy is built on agriculture, in this particular part of the world, the circum-Mediterranean region. And the Romans, when they're building their empire, benefit from a favorable and relatively stable climate. And the centuries of the Roman Empire's demise are a period of climate change, of turbulence, of disturbance in the climate system. And we can even have enough resolution to really focus in on some specific moments when specific episodes of climate change really undermined the project of Roman Empire. So that's part one of the big picture argument. And then part two is new germs, that the evolution of new bacteria and new viruses is a profoundly destabilizing force. And the Romans were always unhealthy. They lived in an underdeveloped society. And it's easy for us to look at the monuments of Roman imperialism and to forget that they lived in a world that was almost unimaginably different in terms of the experience of life and death, of health and disease. Average life expectancy was always very low. But then the kind of background of diseases that infect the Romans changes with the arrival of new pathogens, like quite possibly the smallpox virus and absolutely certainly the plague bacterium, a bacterium called Yersinia pestis, whose arrival in the Roman Empire in the 6th century is one of the most important factors of change that among its consequences includes the fall of the Roman Empire.
It seems like the study of history has now expanded into being paleobiology and paleogenetics and paleo pretty much everything under the sun. How do you deal with that, I guess, expansion of the field? Has it changed your approach to history at all?
Absolutely. I think it's really one of the most exciting things happening in the field. And the only way to practice that kind of history is through team efforts, team science, and collaboration between people who are microbiologists or experts in genetics or immunology or earth science, working with historians, because it's such a challenge to develop the kind of deep disciplinary knowledge. You know, it takes decades to have competence in Greek and Latin and understanding the documentary record and developing the kind of sensitivity to what the historical record that's left by humans says. And it takes that same depth of disciplinary training to be able to understand an ice core or a genome.
So how have the records changed and evolved with regard to the environment? What can we really know about what temperature it was or how much it rained or whether the diseases that they wrote about are the same ones that we're talking about now?
Right. Really good questions. So over the last 150 years or so, human civilization has learned how to exploit fossil fuels on a mass scale. And the consequences of that include massive changes in the atmosphere's chemistry that are driving global climate change on a massive scale and in a terrifying way. So there's been a really urgent need to understand that. How does the climate system work? Because we can't understand how we're changing the climate without understanding the history of the climate, the way that the Earth system itself works. So natural scientists who certainly aren't starting with trying to form hypotheses about Roman history are trying to understand the history of the climate. And to do that, they explore what I call natural archives. So these aren't written records, but they are historical records that are preserved in different ways across the Earth. And this includes ice cores. Tree rings are especially important, very highly resolved historical records of temperature and precipitation. Marine and lake deposits, pollen records, and so on, all contribute to a really rich picture of what the climate was like in the ancient past. So that's one kind of natural archive. The other that I use in the book is genomes. Genes are a historical record. We're carrying around information about our ancestors. And the same is true not just of humans, but also of pathogens. And the amount of genomic data that's available now is just mind-boggling. And it's become far more affordable to sequence genomes, and it's become far more possible to sequence ancient or archaeological genomic data. So one of the really important things that's happened is the ability to recover DNA evidence from, you might call it, murders that were committed thousands of years ago. Archaeologists go and can extract from skeletons, in some cases, the actual DNA of the pathogen that was responsible for the death of the victim. And in the case of the most important episode that I talk about in my book, that is called the Justinianic Plague, it's actually the first plague pandemic. So it's the first Black Death. It's the same bacterium that causes the more famous medieval Black Death of the mid-14th century, actually strikes in the middle of the 6th century. And it's as compelling as any DNA evidence in any courtroom. We actually know what killed these people in the 6th century. And not only do we know what species it was, that it was this particular bacterium that caused the Black Death that's actually still out there today, but we can even start to piece together how it evolved. What are the specific genetic mutations that this particular bacterium had at this particular moment in its evolutionary history? And that's really powerful to be able to say, what are the virulence factors? What are what's the microbiology of this pathogen that let it cause destruction on this scale that's really, really difficult to fathom? The plague in the middle of the 6th century may have killed as many as half of the population. It killed tens of millions of people.
Yeah, that number is so big, it's almost hard to imagine. And that plague was the final death knell in what you sketch out as this four-act tragedy of Roman history. So after the Antonine Plague, after the crisis of the 3rd century, and after the western half of the Roman Empire falls completely apart, only the Eastern Roman Empire is left, but eventually that too falls. So can you set the scene for us for the period before the Justinian Plague, before this fourth stage of transformation that ultimately ends in the empire's collapse?
Sure. The fourth moment of transformation really interrupts this extraordinary renaissance that the Eastern Roman Empire was enjoying. And in the first decade of his rule, the Roman Emperor Justinian manages to codify all of Roman law. So we think of the Justinianic Code. He manages to reconquer Africa and is nearly finished reconquering Italy. He's putting the Roman Empire back together. He goes on this massive building spree that includes some of the most famous buildings of the ancient world, including the Hagia Sophia. Things are really going well for Justinian when all of a sudden the Roman Empire is struck by the most important episode of rapid climate change that we know of from the ancient world, triggered by a series of volcanic eruptions that induce sudden and really violent cooling in the climate system. And right on the heels of this extraordinary moment of climate change comes the most devastating biological event that we know of from the ancient world, the arrival of bubonic plague. And what we know of is the plague of Justinian is this terrifying biological disaster that kills off maybe half the population and sends the what was a resurgent Roman Empire into a tailspin. And we can watch sort of in slow motion the failure of the empire in the aftermath of this environmental crisis.
So was it just bad luck that this double whammy of a plague and an ice age hit at the same time? Or was there something else going on? Was there some kind of vicious cycle between like disease ecology and then this sudden climate change and human activity?
That's a great question, and we don't know all the answers to that exact question, and it's, I think, an important frontier of research right now. I would say that really there's two different answers to your question. One is that the human role in this feedback system is pretty limited, although there is an important human role. The plague could not have struck if the Romans hadn't built a massive trading system with the East, because we have very good reason to believe that the plague bacterium is imported into the Roman Empire across the Indian Ocean, up the Red Sea, and enters the Roman Empire on the Mediterranean shores of Egypt. And so there's a human role in creating the system or the structure that let the plague spread. And we can reconstruct that the Roman way of life, the cities that they built, the grain storage systems that they built, were actually integral to the ecology of the disease. And so the human involvement includes setting up the kind of ecological platform for this massive plague pandemic. But there's also this enormous role of, as you put it, bad luck. You know, the Romans don't cause the episode of climate change. Volcanic eruptions do, and it has nothing to do with human activity in this case. And the climate downturn is just one piece of it, but the climate downturn itself probably has some role in triggering the plague pandemic, the outbreak of the bubonic plague. And right now, we don't fully understand that. And in the book, I try to be careful in hypothesizing and say we don't yet and may never fully understand the mechanisms that connect one to the other. But the analogy I'd use, you hear a bang and then you see someone fall. You know there's a connection between these two. And in this case, we see the bang. There's this unbelievable series of volcanic eruptions that suddenly cool the climate. And then, boom, just a few years later, you have this disease outbreak that's unlike anything that's happened before. And the disease itself, Yersinia pestis, the network of vectors, the rodents, the fleas, all of those are sensitive to their environment, to the climate. So there's, I think everyone suspects that there's some relationship between the climate event and the biological event, but it's an open question exactly how that mechanism works. What I think we can say is that there is a human role. There's a feedback between the global system that the Romans had built, their food system, the way that that creates an ecology that's conducive to the plague. And then there's this really extraordinary role of sheer luck, of bad luck, of fortune.
So your book is a work of history, and you know what they say about it repeating. So what kind of parallels do you see to our own time with rapid globalization, imperialism, and climate change converging on a worldwide scale?
Well, it's a hard question. And our world is very different from the world of the Romans. Climate change in our world is driven by human activity and not by essentially natural processes. And we have germ theory. We have sanitation. We have global public health. And we have a much better chance of being resilient in the face of these kinds of environmental catastrophes. But I do think that there are lessons. I think that the story of the Roman Empire serves to deepen our sense of how dependent human societies are upon the natural environment. This is a really integral part of the success and failure of societies and how societies adapt and respond to the challenges of climate change is really fundamental. I hope it deepens our sense of that. And then on the disease side in particular, we live in a globally interconnected society. And what we call emerging infectious diseases are, I think, one of the most important dangers that we collectively face as a species, as a global community. And so we might think of the Romans as this ancient civilization that live in this world that's unimaginably different. On the other hand, maybe they're a little more like us than we might think. They actually, in some ways, are the beginning of a more modern world. They are becoming globally aware. They are building connections between societies that let emerging infectious diseases travel further and faster than they ever had. And what is absolutely the same about the world of the Romans and the world that we live in is that evolution is constant and it's very dangerous. And the Romans fell victim to what was essentially random evolutionary tinkering with the genomes of viruses and bacteria. And the unintended, unforeseeable effects of those evolutionary changes ultimately overwhelmed their capacity to withstand them. And those same processes are happening today. Germs are evolving all over the world. And I think that maybe history can give us a deeper sense of the longer story of our relationship with the environment and with pathogens and their evolution, and maybe cause us to be more aware of how fundamental those are in the success and failure of human societies.
For more on how history, genetics, paleontology, paleobiology, and all of these other wonderful fields intersect, check out Kyle Harper's book, The Fate of Rome. That's it for Smarty Pants this week, for this year. Join us next time as we explore the artistic avant-garde of Chinese society from the 1970s all the way up to today. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.